First case for argument, Roadway Express. Mr. Posey.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the court, counsels. My name is Thomas Posey, and I represent Roadway Express. This case is before you this morning on Roadway's petition for review of a Department of Labor order requiring the company to reinstate one of its commercial truck drivers, Peter Cefalu. Specifically, that order held that Roadway had terminated Mr. Cefalu in retaliation for protected activity under the Surface Transportation Assistance Act. The issues before the court this morning are, first, whether a harsh discovery sanction imposed by an administrative law judge during the proceedings before the Department of Labor was disproportionate to the circumstances surrounding that, the company's discovery violation. Second, whether Cefalu established the elements of his prima facie case of retaliation under the STAA. And third, whether he established that the company's reason for terminating him, specifically that he had falsified his employment application by concealing a history of trucking accidents, was pretextual. On February 19th of 2002, Roadway learned that Mr. Cefalu, who had been employed by the company since 1999, had falsified his employment application in order to conceal two previous commercial trucking accidents.
Now, before you get into that, Mr. Posey, I would like to focus a little bit on the procedural aspect of this case. And I will say we have a motion pending before us about your brief, and without commenting about how that, you know, whether striking briefs should be done, I think when an administrative judge or a district court refuses to allow evidence in, for whatever reason, it's really your obligation to make that clear, show what the record indicates without that evidence, and then show, you know, you're objecting, of course, that's your right, to the exclusion, and you have essentially proffers what difference that evidence would have made. I found your brief very hard to follow since, you know, lots of sites to Exhibit 6, you know, don't tell me very much. They don't tell me about this. And I also found it rather remarkable that Roadway took the position that without asserting any kind of privilege, without asserting any sort of right, without asking for an in-camera procedure, without in any way responding, just basically said, if we feel like not telling you something, we're just not going to tell you. I mean, how can a judicial process work if litigants take that kind of approach?
Well, Your Honor, the company's response, and this is in reference to one specific interrogatory that Mr. Cefalu had.
Correct. This one witness
discovery
that you said, we've decided that we have good enough reasons to keep this person's name confidential, but you didn't either give the administrative law judge an opportunity in camera with appropriate safeguards to make an assessment of whether that was reasonable. You didn't say that you had some legal privilege to do so. You just basically unilaterally said, we've decided in our wisdom not to tell you. And it's my concern. I just don't see how a judicial process can work if all litigants are allowed to decide for themselves without going through the hoops that we usually require people to go through, what they're going to give and what they aren't going to give.
Your Honor, I would raise 2 points related to that. The first is with regard to this individual whose identity the company didn't disclose. There was a total of 3 individuals who had provided information to the company.
That's not nonsense. Yeah, yeah.
Your Honor, with regard to that particular individual, the company had expressed that there was concerns.
So what was your excuse? I mean, you didn't say it was work product. You didn't say that there's some statute that allows companies to, say, protect whistleblowers or whatever. I mean, there's nothing other than your unilateral decision. What I'm worried about is if we generalize now your position, which is that all litigants now can kind of decide for themselves whether it's worth, it's like the Holmes bad boy theory, you know, whether it's worth complying with discovery or not, that would be very damaging to the system.
It would, Your Honor, but under this
So why do you get to do it?
Under this circumstance, the company felt in good faith and presented that.
Yeah, forget it. Look, your only argument is that the sanction is disproportionate. You don't have any justification for your conduct.
That is correct, Your Honor. I do not have a justification, for example, that it was attorney-client privilege information or work product information.
So if all you're arguing about is proportionality, you basically decided to defy the order, take your medicine, And now you're complaining. Of course, you didn't get the default. There was no default judgment entered against you. And as you just now said in introducing your argument, there are points that you can still raise. This was by no means a procedure devoid of content. I don't see why an order along the lines that, say, on the Federal Rules of Civil Procedure side, Rule 37B would contemplate that restricts you from certain evidentiary submissions is disproportionate.
Your Honor,
certainly not a due process violation. You had plenty of opportunity to comply with the order, and you chose not to. So it's only about proportionality.
It is about proportionality, Your Honor. And it, as I guess to use the words you used a moment ago, that in this case we essentially decided to refuse to produce the information and take our medicine. The problem from our perspective is that rather than giving us our medicine, the Department of Labor essentially pulled the plug on us.
But they didn't. I mean, you just now said, anyway, unless you think they're frivolous arguments, that you have other arguments, even without this evidence.
We do, Your Honor.
You don't think they're frivolous?
Correct.
So they didn't completely pull the plug on you. They just deprived you of asserting a particular defense, which is one of the sanctions that can occur.
They did, however, I would argue that they also took a lot of evidence off the table that belonged there with regard to whether our actions were pretextual, whether we had virtually all the evidence related to our legitimate non-retaliatory reason for terminating Mr. Cefalu was taken off the table by this sanction.
But what the administrative law judge worries about and the board is the scenario where perhaps you had known for a very long time, maybe a year, maybe 6 months, about Mr. Cefalu's dissembling on his application, and you took no action until his testimony in this other proceeding. Now, I don't know if that's true. I mean, but the board mentions that as a possibility, and that would be a very important factor in assessing pretext.
It is, Your Honor, and the company was prepared to produce testimony and evidence from two other named witnesses, Melvin Nensel and Teddy Poshius, who were other employees, to that effect with
but
regard to...
But it wouldn't tell you whether this third person knew. You're not telling us anything about that other than perhaps hearsay from somebody saying, well, I don't think whoever it was, Mr. X, knew. How do we know anything about what this third person knew?
But that question, Your Honor, given that the first and second individuals, Nensel and Poshius, they could testify to when they provided the information to Roadway.
But suppose they say, we provided the information to Roadway, a month before the Gomez hearing, and there was an investigation, and the time frames were more or less going on the same path, so there was coincidence but not causation. That happens. Certainly, I have no problem imagining that that could happen. But it still wouldn't tell you whether somebody else, for all I know, Roadway has known since Mr. Cefalu was hired. I don't know.
Again, Your Honor, if the other individuals would have been allowed to testify, including the decision maker, who was the one who commenced the investigation into Mr. Cefalu's driving record, the dates of that information alone would show that the company did not, at some earlier point.
It wouldn't show that. Because without that third person's testimony, you're just asking us to take somebody's word for it. There's no ability to impeach. There's no ability to test it.
Well, Your Honor, as far as impeachment goes and addressing these witnesses, I think it's important to note that Mr. Cefalu did not make any attempt to address either of the two named witnesses, instead relying on the fact that the third witness was unnamed, and essentially putting his whole argument in the fact that this unnamed individual must have all the information relevant to the case that would allow him to prosecute it.
Well,
beyond that sanction, that as you mentioned earlier, there are other arguments that the company presented, most specifically that Mr. Cefalu didn't establish his prima facie case of retaliation under the STAA despite the sanction that was imposed. The most basic element of that claim is showing that he engaged in some sort of protected activity. Now, as Mr. Cefalu and the department correctly cite in their briefs, the purpose of the STAA is to protect the public from unsafe drivers on the commercial highway, or commercial truck drivers on the highways. To effectuate that purpose, the statute protects employees who give testimony at hearings related to safety where in this case, for example, with other truck drivers, if there was another truck driver who had a hearing regarding whether he was fit to drive a motor vehicle, whether he was doing so unsafely, speeding, driving erratically, et cetera, that employee who gave a statement on his behalf would be protected.
But my question there is why, for what reason do you think we should disagree with the Department of Labor's characterization of its own regulations as pertaining to safety?
Your Honor, because the hearing did not relate to its regulations related to safety. It related to Mr. Cefalu's failure to complete a paperwork requirement associated with his position.
But in their brief, however, the Department of Labor says that particular regulation is related to safety.
They do, Your Honor.
So I'm asking you, on what theory are you telling us that your view of the regulation should prevail over that of the agency that promulgated it?
It's that the hearing that was held was the connection between that hearing and whether Mr. Cefalu was fit to be driving, or I'm sorry, whether Mr. Gomez was fit to be on the road. The connection between that and safety was too attenuated.
So you're saying it's case by, I mean, the department says, you know, and you're free to say, you know, no Chevron deference, or you're free to say what you want, but the department says that structurally speaking, if you will, this record-keeping regulation is an important part of the overall safety regulatory regime. Now, you apparently don't think it is, but I don't quite see doctrinally where that fits in.
Your Honor, even though it fits into that scheme, the specific hearing to be protected under the STA has to relate to safety.
So even if it's a regulation about how fast you should drive in the road, if the hearing doesn't reveal that the person was speeding, it's not a safety hearing?
Well, Your Honor, I think that's a good example of why this hearing would not apply. But one of the cases that we cited in our brief where there was an analogous situation.
That's not quite what I'm asking. I'm trying to figure out why sometimes a particular regulation that's at issue in a hearing does deal with safety, and other times the same regulation in a hearing does not deal with safety.
Because in this case, the hearing did not relate to whether or not Mr. Cefalu had violated.
No, why is the regulation turn on and off as a safety regulation depending on the hearing? Wouldn't it just be a safety regulation or not?
It would, Your Honor, but what we're arguing is that the hearing does not relate to whether or not he violated a regulation. It's whether or not he met the requirement that he had to complete this paperwork, which was the company's, at the time, in the Gomez hearing. The only question at issue was whether Mr. Gomez had completed a log that he was required to fill out when he pulled out of one of the Oasis on the expressway.
But he has to fill out that log because there are regulations that require the companies to keep this data to make sure drivers aren't driving too many hours in the road, to make sure, as it were, that they're safe.
They are, Your Honor. But the fact that there's a tenuous connection between whether he had filled out that paperwork on that day and whether he was actually fit to be driving that day, for example, was too fatigued to be driving, that was not the subject of the hearing. We would argue that if that hearing had been about that he was too fatigued to be driving on that day and Mr. Cefalu gave testimony on his behalf, that it would, in fact, have been protected activity.
Okay.
You want to save the rest of your time?
Yes, Your Honor. Thank you.
Mr. Doyle?
May it please the Court, Michael Doyle on behalf of the Department of Labor. I'd like to address first this.
I understand the reinstatement. I understand how if you prove your case, there should be a sanction of some sort. You don't reinstate a driver with this fellow's record and endanger the other users of the highway just in order to punish roadway. That's ridiculous.
Several responses to that, Your Honor. First of all, there's no evidence in the record regarding this fellow's driving record.
But isn't that a little too much? I mean, there is certainly, at least in the form of proffers, evidence. And I had the same issue. And I also wondered whether it's the position of the Department of Labor that if tomorrow roadway were to dismiss Mr. Cefalu because they think he's an unsafe driver because they now know from his prior employers. Could they do so, or has this proceeding somehow given him life tenure with Roadway or what?
Certainly not life tenure. I think it is a difficult question whether or not if they were to terminate him tomorrow, would that violate the STAA, which is the Department of Labor's concern? And I think it would be a matter of...
What's the answer?
Well, I think the answer would have to be adjudicated in a...
Well, thanks.
I don't think it would be adjudicated
well,
in the...
Great idea. Look, what I don't understand, we have loads and loads of employment discrimination cases, and often there's an issue about reinstatement. Very often the court says, look, you can't reinstate this person. You know, the relations are poisoned and so on and so forth. So you give them damages. So why don't you do that in this case?
Well, first of all, I'm not even sure that there was a...
Pardon?
I'm not sure in this case there was a request for front pay.
Well, who cares? Who cares? Look, you have a responsibility. You're a government agency. You're supposed to care about people's safety. What do you care whether the person asked for a particular remedy?
First of all, the STAA does indicate a strong public policy in favor of reinstatement.
I don't understand you. Look, you can give this person as much as is necessary fully to compensate him for losing his career as a trucker, right? So maybe he can never get another job as a trucker. So he can get some other job, and then the difference between his income and the other job and his income as a trucker, that's his damages. And that's a standard remedy, and it's in the statute.
What do we know that this man is...
trying to balance the public safety against the interest in enforcing the law and compensating Cephalou.
I think if there were a case where there was evidence received that a person was a danger to the highways, that might be...
his record, and he falsifies it and so on.
But again, consider the arbitration cases in which the courts...
Any sense. I don't understand. You have a perfectly good remedy that doesn't involve endangering people, and why don't you ask for that remedy?
The ARB and the Department of Labor has taken the position that the STAA evinces a strong public policy about reinstatement.
Why? When you can compensate the person fully, why do you push for... As I say, look,
I think you're also sending a message of...
Don't interrupt me. There's a very strong public policy enforcement of Title VII for reinstating people who are discriminated against or retaliated against. But nevertheless, judges say in many, many cases... reinstatement is not appropriate because of the bad relations that they have developed between the parties, even if the person wants reinstatement. So you have to settle for, you know, back pay and front pay. So I just don't understand why you haven't even raised this question in this case with the administrative law judge.
The cases that you're talking about, front pay in lieu of reinstatement, are typically cases where the evidence shows, as you just said, a breakdown in the relation between the employer and the employee. They're not based upon some public policy.
Of course there is. What are you talking about? You don't think public... Look, reinstatement is an equitable remedy. And all the formulas about when you grant an equitable remedy say you consider the public interest. That's one of the conventional factors. And public interest includes... safety on the highways.
That's true. Again, I think that to
it's
say
true,
that there's a public...
You seemed to know it 2 minutes ago,
but there's
right?
There's a public policy. To the extent there would be a public policy exception...
To the extent there would... Do you doubt that public policy is relevant to ordering the reinstatement of a trucker?
I think that...
You want to question that?
I think that the strong overriding...
Do you want to question that?
No, I do think that...
Do you want to question that?
I'll...
Do you want to question that? Would you answer my question?
No, I won't question it.
All right.
But I will say that under the facts of this case, we don't know that public policy would bar this person from driving. And I assume this person has a legitimate
according
license
to the...
To drive.
Is it incorrect that he was terminated from two previous driving positions for recklessness resulting in serious accidents?
That was the offer of proof was to that effect.
Excuse me?
The offer of proof was to that effect that, yes. He was fired.
And if that's
that.
True?
If that's true, it's not necessarily true that every person who's been accused of recklessness...
You think a person who has... He's been fired twice because he was reckless, and that resulted in serious accidents, and you, the department, the government, think this person is fit to be a commercial truck driver?
I don't see anything in the STAR or any other federal law that would say that this man is not fit to be a driver.
How about common sense? How about some common sense?
I mean, do we know, for example, whether the state that licenses this driver has seen whether he's fit? The states are usually the front line in determining whether or not this person's fit to have a license.
No, but wait a minute. Look, companies
state,
don't
Illinois,
have to be...
with our crookedness in awarding...
That's an issue
for going to prison
Illinois,
for awarding, for giving... licenses to truck drivers don't speak English?
And besides, look, the state of any state is going to have some standards, but a company like Roadway or any other company might want to have a higher standard of excellence, if you will, in its truck drivers, and they might want to hire only accident-free drivers, and I don't know of anything in the statute that would prohibit them from having that. And so I guess the question... To put it sort of in a more procedural vein, since that's the way you started, is with this offer of proof that he had these two incidents when he was fired for reckless driving on the table, why was it not error at the remedy stage in this case for the administrative law judge not to now accept that evidence in to see whether it holds up? Of course, you could test it. It would be in the record at that point. I mean, it's right there. The judge has been alerted to it, and I don't see why you shouldn't, at the remedy stage at least, take a look at it.
I think that would have been a proper exercise of his discretion.
And so why shouldn't we remand for something like that?
The question isn't necessarily whether it was within the range of his discretion. The question is, did he abuse his discretion
by not doing exactly? So if it is an abuse of discretion not to do that, then there needs to be
right, but I think that the sanction, and I think the ALJ said in the transcript that the sanction applies not only to the question of damages, or not only the question of liability, but also damages.
But why? I mean, what you can make that neutral as to Roadway. You could come up with a number of front pay that would be economically equivalent to reinstatement if you're looking at
deterrence. I agree with that. And I agree that in this case we could have used front pay. But I do think that, again, the extent of the sanction, I think, is something that was broadly within the range of options that the ALJ could have chosen here. Your Honors, I'm out of time.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Doyle. Mr. Taylor?
May it please the Court, my name is Paul Taylor. I represent Peter Cefalu, and I represented Mr. Cefalu in the proceedings below. I'd like to pick up on this argument with regard to whether or not reinstatement is an appropriate remedy in this case or whether or not there should be some sort of remand. Fact is, the evidence in this case, even the offer of proof, does not reflect that Mr. Cefalu was a reckless driver. The offer of proof says what they say it might be. The other thing is there's a whole scheme.
Well, that's what you have, you know, evidentiary hearings for, to decide what the real field facts are.
Indeed, but the statute is very clear and it says shall reinstate.
Oh, come on, don't repeat that silly argument.
Well, it certainly is the ordinary remedy in these kinds of cases.
But not when you have a dangerous driver. I mean, what if he were blind or something? Would you still be arguing he should be reinstated?
No, indeed not. At that point, he wouldn't be able to meet the essential requirements of the job. But what you have
short of that, he could have killed a dozen people in a traffic accident. Wouldn't bother you.
No, it indeed would bother me, just as it would with any other driver bothering me. Mr. Cefalu worked for Roadway for approximately 2.5 years before he was discharged. The order of reinstatement was in May of 2004. We're now approaching 2007, and I would think if he had had an accident in that time period or been reckless, that they would have fired him. On top of it, there is a whole scheme of federal motor carrier safety regulations that have an annual review of driving record required. That's, I believe, in 49 CFR Part 391.
Excuse me, what's Mr. Cefalu doing right now?
He's driving. I think he's actually at home sleeping, but last night he was driving a truck for Roadway Express.
So he is back at Roadway as a result of this?
Well, as a result of a separate enforcement action in the Eastern District to enforce the reinstatement order. But, yes, he has been ultimately returned to work pursuant to a district court order from the Eastern District of Wisconsin.
Okay.
So he was, ultimately, they did obey the district.
Was there a break in his employment?
Yes.
For how long?
I believe about a year and a half. Let's see, the discharge was in February 2002. He went back, and approximately 2.5 years, if I'm correct, if I've done my math correctly. But he worked there for 2.5 years before the firing. The order of reinstatement was in May of 2004. He ultimately went back to work. He's there. The regulations make the motor carrier liable for putting a driver.
Why wouldn't you and he be perfectly content with front pay instead of reinstatement?
Well, you're talking about a whistleblower. If you remove the...
I don't see what that's question.
Because I don't think it's in the public interest to remove a whistleblower from the workplace where drivers who know he was the whistleblower at Roadway. I mean, this is well known. And all of a sudden you're taking somebody who's got fired, went back, been back, was driving yesterday, and you're removing him from the workplace based on an allegation and an offer of proof that he's a reckless driver.
Could I ask you
whether... What if he is a reckless driver, right?
I'm sorry?
What if he is a reckless driver?
What if he is a reckless driver?
Proof was
then Roadway should, if they have proof beyond the excluded evidence, they can surveil him. They can send him to a doctor to see if he falls asleep at the wheel.
But why can't they? It's your position then, though, that they are absolutely forever precluded from going back to the initial misconduct of failing to reveal his true driving record on his job application back
yes.
in 1999.
Yes.
Why can that? I don't see why that isn't somehow independent of whoever this unnamed person was. There are all sorts of reasons he might not be fired for that. Maybe Roadway doesn't usually fire people who do that. They wait and see whether they've accumulated a good driving record at Roadway. I don't know what they do, but it seems to me odd that Roadway is forever precluded from looking at that.
Well, I think that's the penalty they pay for the sanction in this case, Your Honor.
That's the penalty we pay as people sharing the road with. What if he has another accident? Could the company at that point look back and say, well, this is his third, reckless accident? Or is his accident history, following up on what Judge Wood was asking, is his accident history forever excluded from consideration by Roadway?
You're talking in the legal context, not in the collective bargaining context, I'm assuming. I would assume that it would be forever excluded because I think it's incorporated within the parameters of the sanction. They chose to say, Judge Leland, we're not going to answer this interrogatory, which is...
Now you're going to another issue.
Okay.
That's not the remedy issue.
Okay. I'm certainly perfectly willing, Your Honor, to stick with the remedy issue. As I was indicating earlier, there are in 49 CFR parts 390 through 396 approximately a whole set of methods that the motor carrier is responsible to use to make sure they don't have an unsafe driver on the highway.
You're saying that Roadway can never consider his accident history.
No. There's
you
ways
said
of
that.
No. There's
okay.
way right. No, what they got from the confidential source. They're required to do an annual review of his driving record.
You're not answering my question.
Yes.
I thought you said they are forever in the future precluded from using his accident history as evidence of his unfitness to be driving.
No, they are precluded from using the evidence that came from the so-called confidential source.
What about I don't understand you.
But on his application form, he indicates his prior employers.
Yes.
So that comes from him. So what if tomorrow they picked up the phone and called the prior employer, I might say parentheses again, but they call the prior employer and they say, we're calling to find out how Mr. Cefalu did for you as a truck driver, and somebody who they've never talked to before, some new human resources person, at the prior employer says, well, as a matter of fact, here's the record, da-da-da-da-da. That's off the charts, too? I mean, they're now in a very insulated way collecting this information again.
I guess what depends on what the motive was for doing that. I don't think that would be
what the motive is? So we're going to have a second lawsuit, right?
I'm sorry, Your Honor? We're
going to have another lawsuit over his motive now?
I don't know that. I mean, at
in
this
other words, you're saying if Roadway now investigates his driving record, as Judge Wood said, talked to previous employers and so on, whether it is permitted then to fire him will depend on its motive. So you're going to have another litigation, right?
Possibly.
They try to fire him.
Well, there's still a collective bargaining process that would have, obviously, they would have to go through. And I don't know what that provides for, whether or not an accident is just cause. According to Roadway's proffer, though, it was not that the previous accidents, it was his alleged falsification of employment application that led to the discharge.
Okay, well, thank you, Mr.
Thank you, Your Honor.
So, Mr. Posey, how much time does he have? 2 minutes? You have anything further?
Yes, Your Honor. If I could address briefly the issue of whether the reinstatement was an appropriate remedy. Roadway did make an attempt during the administrative hearing, after being advised that evidence was excluded, to enter it solely for the purposes of determining whether reinstatement was an appropriate remedy. It was explicitly excluded again on that grounds only. Since being reinstated, as was pointed out several times during the arguments you just heard, there's been a concern at Roadway regarding the safety of this individual being on the road. The evidence that was presented, not just in the offer of proof, but the documentary evidence that the company obtained showing that, for example, with regard to A&R Advance, one of the companies that had employed Mr. Cephalou previously, that he had, in fact, been terminated from that position because of a trucking accident.
Okay, thank you very much. Thank you to all three counsel. Next.